Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast, and before we start today's episode, I have some community notes. First, this episode is a little out of order, as normally we do a Tomes of Magic episode pretty well every other episode, but our next book in queue was Dark Ages Mage, and I wanted to do the episode on how to run Sorcerer's Crusade before we got to Dark Ages, so it would still be with Sorcerer's Crusade. So this one's coming first. We'll be next covering Dark Ages Mage, a few other supplements in the Dark Ages line as Tomes of Magic episodes, as well as Dark Ages Fae, probably not as a Tomes of Magic episode. From there, we're going to do a mix of Victorian, M20, and Black Cover World of Darkness books, depending on what comes out when. I know we haven't done M20 Sorcerer, we'll get to it. Additionally, we have three special episodes coming up, one being an episode of Walking into Shadow, a conversation I did with Satirist Phil Percato on Paradigm, along with the host, one called Reality Deviance Book Club, which may be the first in the series, on Meiji books and what we can get from them, and another mechanics workshop with the folks from Bonus Experience. Additionally, I'll be running three mage-inflected games of Hunter the Reckoning at Gen Con this year in person. The name of the session is White Collar Wreckage. If you'd like to try and get a table game in with me, look for that there. Otherwise, now that my exam is over, I am catching up on all the projects that I had to put on the back burner so I could shove a lot of math in my head. And I look forward to talking about those as they near completion. And with that, on with the show. Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast. And today, joining me, my co-host, is Victor Kinzer of various projects. And the most important project Victor has been involved in the last year is me going, how do you Sorcerer Crusade? And Victor going, I have competent answers to this. So, Victor, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I am so excited to talk about Sorcerer's Crusade. Yeah. I don't get to do it often enough.
And this is weird because like frequently I will do what I will call a fake interview where I'll be like, let's talk about this. I don't know anything about it. And like the guest will see that I have 11 pages of notes on it. And this time it was like, it's just, I got 11 questions. Let's do it. I feel as if Sorcerer's Crusade and the idea of running a game set in another era or even a significantly different location culturally from yours is kind of the apex of the past is a different country. They do things differently there.
Yep.
And I am not great at navigating it. Like, what do you find or what have you found so attractive about Sorcerer's Crusade as a setting?
So what originally drew me to Sorcerer's Crusade was, ironically, I was just getting out of what turned out to be a somewhat not successful mage game. The storyteller's expectations and all of our expectations as a player in this game did not align, and the game just fell apart. In one particularly disheartening session, it just like, we were done, but everyone wanted to keep playing mage. We'd only been playing for a few months, and it just wasn't, like, we didn't feel like we were done. A lot of players that do long form games. And a couple of the players, when we were talking about, well, who wants to pick up and try to, you know, do a new game, had said, well, I always wanted to play Sorcerer's Crusade. I've never been able to. It's the game I always wanted to play. And in my head, I'm like, I just want to make these people happy because everyone's morale is in the dumps. I'll run Sorcerer's Crusade. You want to play it? I'll run it. And that was what originally got me to run the game. I had a few of the books, I'd read through them. They were fascinating because I love Mage, but in terms of being something I had to absolutely run, it hadn't grabbed me initially more than a number of other things. But then when I was planning that game and I actually got into the period and I read Fragile Path again with a focus on how could this inspire me to actually run a game as opposed to just reading it as fiction, it really struck me that it's a fascinating time period to run Mage. And they're all of the like obvious answers to that. Oh, it's, you know, the rise of reason and all these new things and creation out of nothing. And that is all very Mage. But the other thing that got me is most of what we know about the Renaissance is bubkis. Like, it's just not true. The Renaissance is not a thing that happened across the entire setting at once. It happened in Italy at one time. It happened in Spain somewhere else. It happened in Britain later. And then once you get outside of Europe, it happened some places even earlier. And that was something that just blew my mind when I started researching the setting. And there are so many different things happening at different times. Like now, when you hit an era of the world, it happens globally. We no longer think about the world as disjointed, but the Renaissance is just incredibly disjointed. But we don't tell the story of the Renaissance that way. And so even just going into Wikipedia and being like, what was happening in Venice this year? What was happening in India this year? It was so much fun to get into it and be like, this is what was being discovered. And it'll be discovered a continent away in 50 years and like literally become a reality a continent away 50 years later. And I just think being constantly at the cusp of discovery and having that opportunity to run into someone, run into a culture in the process of a cultural epiphany that maybe you lived through 30 years ago, those are just so many fascinating experiences that are very mage. And I was really drawn to them. I wish the game books captured more of that, but you know, there isn't enough word count. You need to really get into actual, not like necessarily academic historic texts, but at least comparing Wikipedia articles. There's enough there to kind of see that dynamic. Yeah, and I think it makes the setting sizzle for me.
And it's interesting because it just reminds me of a slightly modified version of the William Gibson quote of, the past happened, it was just unevenly distributed. You had a Northern Renaissance that started with figurative art and a Southern Renaissance that started with literature, and each one wound up focusing seemingly on the opposite. And then you find these weird nuggets of history where in like the 12th century, someone's like, what if we changed perspective in art and focused more on the human experience and questioned the papacy more? And you find out that this town held out that way for 75 years until it was crushed by the Teutons or something. And you're like, that would have been very interesting if the Renaissance had started in 1275 in Bulgaria and radiated out from there. Likewise, the historical contingencies of like, oh, what if Islamic Spain had persisted slightly longer? I think one of my favorite bits is in Dead Magic, where they're like, the invasion more or less of Africa had happened a couple years later. It looked like sub-Saharan Africa was kind of on the verge of both a technological and a political revolution. Yeah. That considering the supply lines of the time, they could have successfully pushed back the British. And that kind of historical conjecture seems pretty fascinating. One of the things that you said that seemed interesting was rereading The Fragile Path. What do you get from The Fragile Path when you read it almost as a contemporary document rather than an historical one? So The Fragile Path, the Testament of the First Cabal, is Mage's in-world supplement. It is an artifact that notionally exists within the world of Mage, and it is written by Porthos Fitzempress that regales the tale of the March of the Nine and what they did. And the biggest takeaway for me compared to what I thought was going to be in it was, I know how it turns out. I know Yaldabaoth, what is the appellation given to Halel? Theoboth or something like that. Yeah. And I know how it turns out. And not until you crack it open, you're like, oh, this was a charismatic son of a bitch that people thought had a genuine chance of leading the traditions. And you have this idea that if he hadn't gotten in the way, it would have had this great success, this group of nine united mages just going across the continent. And then you read it, and he's like, we spend the first 3 hours of every day praying, meditating, and sharpening our weapons. We move like 9 feet every month, and every time we move more than 100 miles, none of us can speak with any of the people here. This is stupid. And you're like, yes. Oh, mage is hard. Maybe having access to the sphere of logistics is really what sets the technocracy apart. So what do you gather from that text kind of when you read it as a contemporary work as opposed to as a historical one?
Yeah, so there are two things you get. One, as a storyteller, you get character ideas. So most of the characters that are adults and kicking around in The Fragile Path, depending on where you put your Sorcerer's Crusade game in the main Sorcerer's Crusade timeline, are probably not around anymore, but they were very powerful. Lifetimes are a question mark. But then there are the twins, because Halel had kids. And I ended up using them as characters and, you know, using it as a story of origin can be really interesting. The other thing I think you get is, what is it going to be like for these characters? How are your PCs going to interact? Because in a contemporary setting, we're the nine traditions, we're the mystics, we do our own thing. But am I a euthanatos and am I going to go cooperate with that virtual adept? Yes, I am. That is not true in Sorcerer's Crusade. It's just not. Well, we're really afraid of the Order of Reason, so I guess we have to cooperate, but God, I hate you. And truth be told, Sorcerer's Crusade game, when I started that Chronicle, all of the dynamics in the Fragile Path happened with my PCs. All of them. They were exactly like that. All of the, we have different perspectives on the world. You know, I had a couple of Kashiyana. I had a Batini who was a traitor and had gone back and forth between continents. I had a very like tied to her place, dyed in the wool Verbena. I had a burgeoning hermetic, and they did not get along at all. And I had a little bit of the Order of Reason as a boogeyman to draw them together. It only kind of worked. We eventually gelled, but it was forcing themselves through challenges and then, you know, having the bond of shared hardship finally got those individuals over that hump. But reading The Fragile Path and thinking about what does it mean to have these people with dramatically different worldviews, beliefs about reality, forced to cooperate without any of the smoothing out that the contemporary setting does. Because at the end of the day, you know, I'm a Verbena, but you know what? I've got a smartphone, because of course I do. And like, that is meaningful, and you do not have that in the Renaissance.
No,
like, there is not that commonality. So if you're going to run Sorcerer's Crusade, read The Fragile Path and be like, this could happen. And be ready for it.
Someone being a plague doctor in Black Death Kolkata has vastly more in common with a member of the Order of the Rule or the Machinist Guild than they do with most hermetics. Like, just kind of that idea of what is the role of elitism? And it's like, yeah, they pick their prime eye by pulling it out of a hat. You have a wizarding duel and then talk about how many colleges you've been to. This is very apples and oranges. Yeah, it's just one of those things where the space of paradigm had not drifted enough that the gaps between paradigms made it easy to draw clear circles around things. Like, the Solificato sense of exploration of inner space may have matched the Celestial Master's sense of exploration of outer space more than it made sense to talk about somebody talking about how important it is to maintain your sense of place or something like that. So yeah, the potential circles that you could draw around what we now view as conflicting paradigms seems kind of interesting. And I kind of wish we had more of that in contemporary setting, where it's like, oh, that's interesting. These two are actually closer to each other across factions than the rest of anything else. That's not a metaphor for modern politics in America at all, but still.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Second side question. Are you excited to see Victorian Age come out?
I am. I'm very excited to see Victorian Age come out, in no small part because I wrote on Victorian, and I wrote some of the stuff that I wrote in Victorian came directly from my Sorcerer's Crusade Chronicle. The big thing are some of the details for the Celestial Masters. So getting to that, different things happen at different times. I've always been a huge fan of the Void Engineers and their predecessors. And I read the Void Engineers book, and I love Tycho Brahe, and I loved how they used his like intermediate cosmological setup, intermediate between the, you know, Earth-centric and then eventually the Sun-centric models. He kind of got halfway there with the math. And the first thing I wanted to do is I knew I wanted a Celestial Master in my Chronicle on the Order of Reason side. So I started doing research on what would they know, what would their practice be, what would their relationship to Tycho Brahe be. And Tycho Brahe was 7 in the time period. And I went,
yeah.
What? And I looked at like who was doing complex astronomy work, and I started my game in 1501. So it's not even like the very beginning of the Sorcerer's Crusade time period. It's like a third of the way in. He would have been 7. I mean, it was somewhere in that ballpark. And there was nobody else in Europe that had made any like breakthroughs really on getting away from the, you know, Earth-centric model. And I'm like, this can't be right. And I started doing research. And what I discovered is the model that Tycho Brahe came to was originally discovered in India in the Kerala School of Astronomy and Mathematics, I believe is the name. I might be slightly tweaking that name. I need to look it up. And there is a text, and it really exists, and you can still get it. And it's originally written in Sanskrit, I believe. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but I'm going to try. It is the Tantra Grasanthma, I believe. And I went, wait, so Tychoides, the originator of this entire paradigm in the World of Darkness, who is based on Tycho Brahe, could not possibly have done any of the work that would justify the Celestial Masters having a paradigm in Europe at this time period. And yeah, okay, fictional setting. I can muck about and say he had lived earlier, but I kind of didn't want to because this thing was discovered in India. And so I built that into my game. And then when Victorian happened, I'm just like, I'm just putting that in their history. That's going in. I refuse to give Tycoides credit for this. I'm just not going to do it. And it made it through redlining and it's in those pages. And so I'm super excited about a bunch of the stuff that went into Victorian. It's a different setting. It's not nearly as fractured, but it's not as unified as the contemporary era either. And I like that. Like, yeah, wandering around Europe, you're going to have a fairly unified experience in the Victorian era. Not perfectly unified, but fairly consistent. But then like the Wild West is a valid setting. And what's different in that setting is the people who are far enough away that it's different still know about Victorian England. You know, the person living out on the frontier knows that Victorian London exists. They know that if they just push through the frontier far enough, they get to San Francisco, where we kind of skipped the frontier and did some extra things in California. Like, they know that the world is fractured and that it won't be for that much longer, like that's ending. And that's a whole different kind of anxiety that I think is exciting, but it's still a very different set of experiences than the Renaissance.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking back to the Kerala school and the fact that all of this would have probably have been done in Tamil or Malayalam. So someone is like, I have found the great text of wisdom. And the school Victor is alluding to is notable because before the invention of calculus, this is one of the first examples we have of infinite power series being used to some things, which is very useful for irregular shapes. A link to the text Victor mentioned will be in the show notes. And to just pull it out, and I don't know if you've seen Malayalam script, but you're like, this is all just boobs. This is all just like and your Celestial Master being like, what the dink? It's not even in Latin. What the hell? And then they find out, well, surely it must be it's Dravidian. It shares precisely zero word roots in common with us. I always had a dream that I wanted the Sorcerer's Crusade, the fight between the three, as it were, to be in the pre-Victorian, like slightly before, where the traditions and the technocracy actually wind up forming in the 18th century, and then the real Ascension Wars in the 19th century, and then the realization that, oh, we're not in charge of this anymore at all, comes in the 20th. Like, I always felt like it is so perfect that Victoria does the technocratic reorg that a sleeper had to tell the technocracy, no, this is what you're doing now, as a perfect symbol that at best the technocracy can kind of steer the elephant that it is on. It does not get to control it. So it sounds like you chose the early 16th century, the early 1500s. Sorcerer's Crusade has received spans almost 150 years, which is a lot. So what goes into picking where you want to run in that period, and how did you make that choice?
So in my case, I started out with some period inspiration. So I was running the game when like 15 different series about the Borgias were running. I don't know why we got so many dramas about the Borgias at the same time. But
Borgia Toba Frist.
Yeah, it really was. And my husband was watching one of them, and I thought, okay, I'm going to do the Sorcerer's Crusade game. Man, there's some great villains here. And so I started out by looking up Caesarea Borgia, because I thought I didn't want him to be an immediate enemy. I was originally planning on building up to him as an enemy. We didn't go in that direction because you got to follow your players. But he was pulling some distant strings for a lot of it. The original setting was in Venice. I picked Venice because I wanted Caesarea Borgia to be an antagonist. And that was a period where Venice had a patriarch. They had a head of the church that they considered to be totally independent of the Pope. Like, they ran their own church, but they were still Catholic. Like, they weren't a schism sect. It just, the politics of Catholicism at that point were so much more complicated than we think they are. And I thought, okay, this will create some really interesting tensions. So I found an anchor point and then went, okay, now that I know I want this, what else is going on in this year. You know, if this is the year I need it to be for this villain, this main character, wouldn't have to be a villain, it was in my case, to be at the point in their story that it's, you know, going to lend itself to the story I want to tell. What else is going on? What other historic tidbits can I pluck? And that was the approach that I took to finding my time. I could definitely see an approach where you start out and say, all right, well, I know I kind of want to be in Spain. When does really the Renaissance go through Spain? And you go and you kind of look at that and look at how the Renaissance progressed and instead sort of pick a setting and a mode. But I would really start with some concrete thing you want for your story and find the anchor that's going to give you that nexus, and then let that, you know, decide exactly when and where you want the setting to be. And then you can find the other details from there.
And it's kind of weird to be like, yeah, Italy, as we know it, didn't exist. It was a collection of city-states plus the Papal States plus 30 republics. Like seeing something like the Duchy of Milan or the most serene republic of Venice as a phenomenon. And then you read stories of like Venice fending off the Ottomans in their little skirmishes. It is ridiculous to me to be like, oh yeah, Chicago declared war on Gary, Indiana, or like just as a phenomenon. So you talk about the Renaissance going across an area. What does that mean to you?
So for me, and I think of this very much in terms of reality zones, the Renaissance in the world of darkness would be a sweeping shift in reality zones. Because, you know, you had waves of art, waves of philosophy, waves of engineering, you know, when you think about all of the machining that Leonardo da Vinci did, and just waves of changing in mercantilism and economic models and trade. And, you know, in a mage context, a lot of that's driven by the Order of Reason, arguably all of it, but not everybody would want the Order of Reason to be wholly responsible for that. And so that hit different regions at different times and in different ways. You know, the Renaissance in Britain was not the same as the Renaissance that happened in Italy, you know, because things had already developed. And suddenly, you know, when those things changed in Britain, you could already trade for a lot of things that had development and it was influenced by what had come before, but also because travel and communication weren't instant, had much more regional, local flavor and distinct characteristic. So for me, it's really about a transformation of the reality zone, if we're thinking specifically in mage terms.
When a warm front transitions to a cold front, there is frequently a storm. When a reality zone shifts, do you think that there is a psychic or supernatural phenomenon? Do you think that that war or that change just kind of happens, like maybe the changing of a season? Or is it something where you go into the Umbra or the Penumbra and there's literally a war raging as Umbrood of the prior reality zone are fighting against the new things? Is there a way in which you reify or make solid that reality zone? Is it something that you represented with changes in rules at all? Like, what did being on that frontier look like in a systems and setting sense, if you had any of those changes?
Yeah, I did have some of those changes, specifically because my campaign ended up traveling. My players burned out their initial setting. Hubris reared its ugly head and they were like, ah, the Order of Reason isn't a thing. We don't need to care about them. We can spit in their coffee. And I was like, no, you can't. I'm sorry. The welcome to repercussions. They were like, we better leave Venice. So they ended up traveling quite a bit. We went from Venice and then we went into India and then they moved all the way into China. We had the transit between India and China is very complicated. There was definitely a lot of that warring going on in the Umbra. I think the initial setting in Venice, we had well into Italy's Renaissance. So that warring turbulence had already settled. It wasn't so much a focus of that first story arc, but definitely when they started traveling, it became much more of a dynamic that they had to navigate. And there was a lot going on with the spirit. So I did pull in some stories with Autochthonia once we got big and epic, because this did go all the way up to master level, and master level in Sorcerer's Crusade gets pretty zany because reality is permissive and you've got fifth level spheres. That's absolutely as wild as it sounds. So
also, this is an era where you can summon Paradox, and Paradox goes, nice work, helps you smite your enemies, and then disappears again.
Yes, yes, it does. There was at least one Scourge roll where the Scourge triggered on a 10, which is when a good thing happens, and the player had like 9 Scourge, and they were doing an epic, nearly impossible task that they were like, well, I gotta try. And that roll almost broke Venice. It was fantastic. And it's so much fun to come up with ridiculous rewards when you get a positive Scourge roll. But also when you get a big negative Scourge roll, I was much more punishing than I am with Paradox. Because I'm like, this could have been really cool for you. So it needs to be worse when it's not cool for you. So yeah, I mean, Scourge is a whole different thing. But in terms of the Umbrood, I did a couple things. One particular part of the story is I told the story of the Changeling shattering. So I had it as like right on the edge of actual Fae, like as written up in Dark Ages Fae, could show up and you could see them and interact with them and remember them. And then I was having the Order of Reason really starting to put pressure on Venice, which the players were provoking and accelerating, as I alluded to earlier. And I had those two worlds collide, and they got to see the fall of the House of Skaha, like the complete descent and subsummation out of being true Fae, which to some of them was like, okay, this is fine. That doesn't bother me because they're parasites anyway. And to some of them, it was absolutely abhorrent. And so that was interesting to like show that to a mage at a point in the canon where you can do that without just ignoring all the rules about the mists, because, hey, the mists don't exist yet, but they will soon. So that was an interesting little crossover story.
Just for context, what were the true Fae?
So the big difference is they actually physically existed. You could walk up to a fairy and interact with them, and they would be very much like, you know, the stories from fairy tales, Rumpelstiltskin or the Blue Fairy, or I'm going to say Maleficent. I don't believe that was her name in the original Sleeping Beauty, but the fairy that came and was offended because she hadn't been invited and did all those things. They're an actual entity. The big thing that's unique about true Fae in classic World of Darkness is they're in a constant state of rewriting their own story. There's a whole setup in Dark Ages Fae where you basically just forget stuff. You're like, oh, I'm done with this part of my identity. I want to be something else now. And so you just like rewrite your identity, and it's described as how they live for millennia. So a vampire lives for millennia and goes Methuselah, and we all know how Methuselahs get. And it's basically like you can have a millennia old fairy, and they'll remember some things from a millennia ago, but then they've just like discarded a century here and a decade there. And a major part of why their memories from this century matter, they kept the memories because they were pretty, but all the meaning is gone. And they replaced it with other stuff. And that's how they're fine now. I find that fascinating, especially from a mage context of like, how would a human make sense of that? And mages especially are just 100% meaning. Like, I have this drive, I have this daemon, to use the Sorcerer's Crusade term, and it, you know, drives me forward, and everything is meaning, and I need the world to be a certain way. And here you have this spiritual entity that does it. Like, even a spirit has like a spark and a meaning that they stick to, and fairies just don't. And so I found watching the death of that, or the capture of that in a human soul, to be interesting. And I started the whole story out with the Dauntain. So before they met the true Fae, they found this child that was being experimented on by the Kosians that had become a changeling, and the Kosians had poked it and prodded it and tried to like deal with what they viewed as the parasite inside of it, and pushed him into being a Dauntain and just being the most toxic, horrible, awful thing. But the thing I did is the Kosians weren't malevolent. Like, they were trying to like protect the human that had had its soul kicked out by this fairy to become a changeling. But that's the only way it could survive. So I wanted to set this thing up where, like, the wondrous thing is killing people and is a parasite, but does it have a right to exist? And I felt that, like, navigating what's right about that? And is the Order of Reason really wrong, to be a very mage conundrum to put in front of them? The players came to very different conclusions.
From you or from each other?
From each other.
Okay, got it.
I didn't give them conclusions. I intentionally left it morally ambiguous because I wanted them to have to chew on it and decide what to do with that. And they had some rousing fights with each other over that one.
So it sounds like it is a case where almost your world, in a weird way, is full of little reality realms of it, where one, we can have more spirits kicking around, we can have a bit more odd moving around, and also that other places are more different. Did you research places and say this was interesting, or did the players bring up things like you talked about going to ancient China, which at least in Sorcerer's Crusade is presented as kind of the most civilized place in the world? What kind of did you use to help pick places? And it seems as if each place was almost sui generis at the time, that there was no, it wasn't one of those things where, like, yes, China is different, but they still have Coke machines like we may have now. What was the process of figuring out those locations, or alternatively kind of researching it?
So a lot of it was driven by what would be the reasonable transit at the time. So even once we got to the master level where it's like, well, we've got five levels of correspondence, we could go wherever we wanted, I still didn't make that easy because it became a limiting factor in terms of paradigm. Like, yeah, you could technically get enough successes with an extended ritual to go drop into the new world, but there's a reason that didn't happen a lot, even though masters were more common back then. And so I made them navigate not even understanding how to look there. Like, if they had known enough to know existence went that far, they could look. But even with fifth level correspondent spirit, they would have to do that journeying, the discovery part of it first. And so we ended up, you know, kind of looking at what was the story, how did it develop, and what avenues of travel did that open up? So what I ended up doing when they kind of spit in the Order of Reason's tea in Venice is I had set the game, I forget exactly how far ahead, but it was a few decades ahead of the first time that transit would happen south of Africa. So when I started the campaign, it was the height of Venetian power because Venice sat at the very end of the trade routes to the east and everything had to go through Venice. But only a few decades later, you have the first trip that just sails around Africa for the first time that's accomplished. And as soon as that became a reality, Venice fell into a very long, very unfortunate depression because they were used to being the center of the world and suddenly they didn't even matter anymore and they didn't know what to do. And so the players were there and they spit in the Order of Reason's tea and I went, cool, that's going to happen three decades earlier. The Order of Reason is going to prioritize that trip. And what is that going to do to the local quintessence? It's going to decimate it. And I had them do like fifth level node restructuring using that trip as their paradigm. And I'm like, what are you going to do to stop it? Good luck. And so once that happened, it became, well, you could go into Europe if you wanted. You could go find other European pastors, or we could go into India. And I presented it to the players. I went, where would you want to go? And so especially at that point, they said, oh, let's go into India. They had characters from the East. They had a character who was a merchant who knew the Silk Road. So it just kind of made sense to go in that direction. And so that's kind of how we decided to go there. And then once that was decided, then I kind of picked the place in India. I ended up setting it in Kerala because they had befriended that celestial master. The Order of Reason was not kind to her for various sundry reasons. They wanted credit for things that were her work. And so she ended up traveling with them back to her homeland. We use that as the story anchor for why are we going to this place in India. Once that was done, I spent a lot of time in Wikipedia, in other articles, and trying to find books and YouTube videos. I didn't necessarily go all the way into academic writings. I don't really think you need to do a World of Darkness story. And I just tried to find out what were the politics like in Kerala? Who would the leaders have been? What would their relationships have been to each other? Was it a fairly free society? Was it, you know, fairly oppressed? And then input World of Darkness like characters into that structure and try to capture that tone and that culture. And so that was kind of how I did that. We did a whole story out in the Indian Sea. I put them on a pirate vessel and I went, we're going to do a high swashbuckling, ridiculous, you know, you are not no longer in formatted space. Because if you get out into the ocean in Sorcerer's Crusade, forget the Umbra and the physical world are still the same place. Like, you haven't had enough shattering that out in the deep ocean, they're different things. And so we got to play around with that a little bit. So not every setting was entirely a culture in place setting. And I would say each story lasted between like 3 and 5 months. I think China was the shortest one. I tried to go like super high politics because I wanted to do a high politics story and it didn't sync with the care with the players. So we didn't stay there very long. But yeah, you are right. They were all very, very different settings.
What did you make the Umbral Sea look like?
The Umbral Sea was, I mean, visually and aesthetically, it was the sea. And I played around with dragons. And, you know, I tend to like to use the main creatures from the other, you know, big five games as just kind of stand-ins. I like bygones. I'll pull in bygones occasionally, but I think there's a lot of flavor to pulling in a Korax or whatnot, but not focusing on their culture in Mage. So when I want to pull a random monster, I usually grab another big five game as opposed to like Gods and Monsters. And so they had they got stuck in a bit of a war between Weresharks and Murs, and there was at least one fight with like a fully manifest bygone dragon. And so the politics were very alien. They weren't very nuanced, but the Weresharks wanted them dead because the Weresharks viewed them as absolutely, you know, appalling affronts. And the Murs were slowly dying when ships came by because that's part of the Merfolk story, that I'm underwater, I'm a fairy, that's great. Oh no, a reality zone is going on top of me and now I'm going to drown. And I was having that starting to happen while at the same time, like I sent the players underwater and it seamlessly transitioned into the Umbra and everyone experienced it without spirit. So in that respect, aesthetically, it was very Davy Jones, very, very much what you'd see on a pirate sort of adventure, but just weirder and stranger in terms of the things that came and went as though it was completely normal. They didn't feel the need to stay hidden the way they do in the contemporary setting.
Did you use the trichotomy between Cray's Shallowings, Regios, and so on, that you essentially have a place of Gauntlet Zero that a mage can cross over, but a normal can't, but Shallowings, anyone can go through? The setting introduces some interesting contrivances that are never really followed through.
I didn't. And this, as a storyteller, I tend to pick up rules when they serve theme. And if a rule just seems like I don't need the full rule to get the theme across, I tend to streamline. And so I really liked the theme of, you know, nothing about spirit, but like, welcome to spirits messing with you. Because normally only the mages that have spirit have to deal with spirits seeing them. And now everything sees you and everything can stalk you. And just transitioning into that space, I thought was interesting. I also like that more even from a mortal standpoint, especially in Sorcerer's Crusade, because when you think about the fairy tales, that a lot of times we think of fairy tales with sort of a medieval or Renaissance lens, even though they're much older, the kind of time period they're frozen in our consciousness is somewhere in there. You have very normal people just wandering off into nowhere and being stuck in spirit. And that's a very normal experience. So I didn't use those rules. I was just like, boom, the Umbra and the physical world are the same thing out here. Deal with it.
Did you ever use Bygone Bestiary kind of introduces a special class of bygones, which is basically the mortal creature that is symbolic and special. Like, one of the things that happens in Sorcerer's Crusade is just you have the option of kind of steeping the entire game in this Christian veneer of just kind of what is understood. Did your game include that at all, or was that very place and person specific?
That was very place and person specific. That overall tone and the kind of archetypical bygones did have a little bit of a place in the European setting. I think the Patriarch, because the Patriarch ended up being a villain separate from the Order of Reason. He was actually a bit touched by fallen influence. And he did have some bygones that were sort of archetypical of him that the players had to deal with. But especially once we got out of Europe, I didn't mess around with that, if only because that sort of model, I guess I think of it as you kind of need to know what you're representing, what the archetypical manifestation is. And I was working in cultures where I was doing a lot more manual research. And so it was a little bit easier for me to just be like, cool, I've researched this area. I'm going to put the more approachable, like, World of Darkness, urban horror fantasy layer on top of that and just run with that. So that was really the approach that I took once we got out of Europe, because I don't know that symbolic language quite as intuitively.
It seemingly is an option that they present, that all of Western Europe is going to kind of be steeped in this, that everyone knows the cow is a seductress and the rabbit is a sign of victory in battle, and roosters bring bravery and so on. So that would be worked into the sacred geometry of a place. And you're like, wait, this place looks like a chicken. That means we fear not. And you're like, what the dink? And it's, yeah. It's just a reminder of like, oh yeah, Europe, I get your... You don't get Europe.
True.
Another thing you mentioned, though, is the fact that this game has the Order of Reason and has magical factions. If you want to move up the Protestant Reformation and say the Celestial Chorus was kind of pushing for this early on, mm-hmm. as kind of the firebrand heretics that they are in this era, it is surprising how like punk rock the Celestial Chorus is in Sorcerer's Crusade, where it's like, oh, they're all heretics.
All of them. All of them.
The Bettini are closer to Islam than the Chorus is closer to Christianity, even though in our contemporary books, they're like, yeah, the Celestial Chorus was kind of dominated by the Messianic voices for a couple centuries, which is not untrue. It is just the fact that they were not in concordance with any church, which mm-hmm. I would have loved to have seen a list of their heretical views, as it were. I think that would have been interesting, like the nine heresies of the Celestial Chorus or something like that.
Well, and the thing that really draws that into focus, you know, we think about the Celestial Chorus as being Christianity, especially before M20. M20 did a better job of highlighting some of the other pockets of Christianity, but even in M20, the technocracy is very anti anything spiritual. And then you get back into the Order of Reason. You get back into Sorcerer's Crusade, and it's like, oh, wait, what do you mean the Order of Reason is Christian? So like Christian, capital C, Christian, Catholic. And that is self-evident to anyone who's like really thinking about the time period. Well, of course they would be. But when you stop and think about like the fundamental thesis of Mage, you're like, wait, this breaks the fundamental thesis, doesn't it? And then you start reading about the Order of Reason and you realize the Sorcerer's Crusade does not have the Ascension War as we understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't exist. The propaganda is, oh yeah, we've been at odds the whole time. The thing that really struck me about the setting is when I finally got my hands on the Order of Reason book, I didn't own it when I started this campaign. I bought it like halfway through. And I opened it up and I started reading it. I'm like, oh wow, they are not a unified sect at all. Like, they are not the technocracy that will come into existence. And the thing that's really interesting is the Gabrielites were not invited. The Gabrielites were not supposed to be in the Order of Reason. They forced their way in and they went, we are the Catholic Church. And if you try to do this without us, we will end you. And everyone else went, oh, right, you could do that. Well, I guess you're part of the club now. And resented the hell out of it.
And if you're looking for mechanical backing for that, we get notes that the Gabrielite Hellfire armor, you do strength plus 8 aggravated damage, and with the armor on, you have a strength of 6. So that is remarkably persuasive. So we don't quite have the sphere of gun, but we have the sphere of sword. And with and with battle tank armor, it can get you remarkably, remarkably far. And it was kind of funny because I remember you and I talking about what you did with the craft masons essentially turned into something else in the Victorian era.
Yeah, so this is weird because officially the craft masons were disbanded before the Victorian era. And so it's not a direct line, but the Brotherhood of International Mechanicians, when I got the outline for Victorian, they were described as the closest thing the technocracy had to a blue collar convention. That was kind of the prompt. And when you get an outline, there isn't a lot of text because you're the writer. You're supposed to write the text, but you're given prompts for kind of everything. And I looked at that and I thought about the craft masons and I thought, this is the Victorian era. So like Marxism matters. And Marx's whole view was all value comes from labor. That's literally the craft mason paradigm. Like that is the craft mason paradigm. All value comes from labor.
I think the best summary of the craft masons is their view of Solomon.
Yeah.
And you have the Batini and the Taftani are like Suleiman, master of the Jinn, the Hermetics, who are like Solomon, the wise, imposer of will, disseminator of order. And then you have the Gabrielites, who are like misguided but followed true reason where it brought him. And then you have the Crass Masons, who are like, did you see that temple though? Holy shit.
Yep.
That fucker could lay down a plinth. Like,
yeah.
And I remember you talking about it. I'm like, oh, crazy communist Victor is talking about it. And then I crack open the thing on the Craft Masons. I'm like, oh, wow. This would make most communists I know, like, I have no idea how to finish that sentence. Like, the
doubt their commitment?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, oh, man, these guys go hard.
Which
I certainly appreciated, because that was a super fun bit of the Artisan's Handbook. Mm-hmm. Where you have the craft mason, you show the kind of the craft mason artisan dichotomy, where the artisan can come up with any effect they want in an evening, but it will work once in front of a group of up to 15 people, where the craft mason builds a machine in the form of a town that produces equality or wonder or education or health or something like that, just because they masonried real good.
Yeah,
which is both wildly more and wildly less vulgar once you kind of think about it.
Yeah. And so what I wanted to do in terms of like the craft masons to the International Brotherhood of Mechanicians was have them be a little bit more like the connection between the Gabrielites and the NWO. There is not a direct path between the Gabrielites and the NWO, but there's a very indirect path. We're shattering the Gabrielites because we're not having Christianity in our technocracy anymore. The convention is gone, and some of them, like, where do all those members go? The members go somewhere. Some of them went off and became the Knights Templar. Some of them went, all right, we'll give up our Christianity, and they became various things in the middle technocracy. Eventually, they became the NWO. I imagine the International Brotherhood of Mechanicians as being kind of what hoovered up all of those craft masons that were left without a convention. And so some of their belief and paradigm made its way into that era and resonated with that era accordingly. But yeah, I think that there's an interesting indirect line between the two eras that you can really draw.
Now, so another thing that you brought up was the Taint of the Fallen. And another thing that has happened now is we don't really have a unified Nafandi. We don't get any information on really there being labyrinths as we know them now. They're like, oh, yes, I have heard rumors of a labyrinthine underground structure. What do you consider to be the major internal tensions or questions for each of the factions in a game at this time?
That's rough. So I think in terms of the Fallen, if you want to be very true to what's written, then you end up with more a creeping influence of infernalism. And the idea of might makes right, that is so embedded in just the way everyone thinks at the time. Like, colonialism isn't questioned. You know, the right to push your influence on the world is just, of course, that's fine. That's the way it works. And so a lot of what will eventually become the philosophy of the Fallen is just disseminated. But there's a point where you go too far, according to the morals of the time. And so I do think there's kind of an interesting idea to be presented that maybe the calls didn't exist during Sorcerer's Crusade.
Hmm.
You know, maybe what would eventually become the spiritual influence that would manifest as what would become the Nafandi was the result of the world collectively going, oh, maybe this isn't all right. Maybe predation isn't an okay default. Maybe might doesn't make right. But then that always takes the people that cling to that reality and intensifies them in the same way that the traditions were empowered by the order of reason in a very strange way. You could have had a very similar thing that resulted in the concentration that we now experience as the Nafandi, and the spiritual manifestation of the calls could have been, you know, whatever working. So I think from the question of thinking of them as a faction, you have some seeds that there's a book out there that maybe the Batini are accidentally responsible for that is spreading corruption. And, you know, you have the seeds of what will become the Nafandi. And of course, there's Infernalism, Path of Screams. There's tons written about demonology in the period. But I don't think there's a centralized faction there. I do think with the traditions, the fundamental question is, what are we doing? Like, we're losing. The world we know how to exist in really is kind of already gone. I mean, if you're in a couple parts of Europe that maybe developed later, maybe it's not gone yet, but for most of Europe, for most of this period, the writing's on the wall. And the, we're going to fight it, and we're going to, you know, go back to the way things were. Anyone who says, I'm going to go back to the way things were in the world of darkness is in the middle of self-delusion. In any time period, that's the central theme of the world of darkness. You can never go home again. And so the central question that everyone's kind of like avoiding, but they all know is there, is what are we going to become? And I think that's their central question. Whereas for the Order of Reason, the central question, even though most Daedalans, the term for members of the Order of Reason, since we don't have technocrats yet, even though most Daedalans or Daedalians haven't necessarily realized this is the question yet, I think the central question for them is, will we be heroes? Because there's already evidence that the venture isn't going as planned. And it's written. I mean, the stereotype the craft masons have for the rest of the conventions is, well, this was a nice idea, but it failed. We need to start over. Like, that's already their stereotype in the Sorcerer's Crusade setting. And so some of the people have looked at what's happened, the way the Gabrielites corrupted the experiment, the fact that the Soul of Akkadi went, thanks, bye. Like, we failed as a tradition, but they like left the Order of Reason first. And like the writing is also kind of on the wall there, but in a way that like you can delude yourself out of a little bit more easily. And so the question of like, can I be a hero? Or is this hubris? I think they're already deep in that and struggling with it, as opposed to even the Victorian era technocrats. You get a little bit of that with the international, like with the mechanicians and with the conventions that will eventually defect. But most of the technocracy is committed by the Victorian. Like, they are in it to win it. In Sorcerer's Crusade, it's more ambiguous. And you get to struggle with that. And is it there still an opportunity to course correct? So I think that's their big question of like, will we become monsters or will we be heroes?
And to back up Victor's observation, the stereotype section for the Craft Masons, Core Rulebook, page 151, with the exception of the Artificers, this crumbling cathedral needs to be ruined and built again. A shame, really. It took so much work. And they're looking back on the foundation in 1325,
yeah,
or 1275, if you want to go back further. You're talking about the middle of the 15th century, and they're already like, no, we need to build something newer. So, like, to me, the things to keep in mind is the Order of Reason is older than the traditions at this point. They are,
yeah,
kind of the established thing. A lot of the traditions needed to be formed so that they could go to respond to the call of Horizon, so that they could go to the Grand Convocation. So it's one of those things where there's also a fair amount of internal tension within the traditions. Like, the Euthanatoi and the Chakravanti kind of recognize that they rhyme with each other lightly, but it's also a period of time where the Euthanatoi that are used to just kind of keeping track of reincarnations and the Akashiyana that do the same thing very clearly have way more in common with each other. So it seems like another fun thing you can play with is like, what if the cards landed slightly differently? Like, what if House Bjornair stayed with the Hermetics, for instance? So that's the shape-shifting house that was like, we're obviously Verbena. And when I read over it, I'm like, no, you're Hermetics. Like, you bring, yeah, the tools to it. The shape-shifting thing you share, but at the same time, we get information on the Nagoma that are doing the exact same thing. So I like the notion of being able to play around with that. And it is hard to think back to what it is like to be in what will be a massive organization when everything is young and unsettled. It is, yeah, weird to read the Federalist Papers and to be like, this is someone hypothesizing about a thing that doesn't exist yet. You look back at ancient Babylon or Nineveh and you're like, the Grand Temple stood for 1,400 years, but it was rebuilt on average every 50 to 70 years. And when you started, they didn't know it was going to be the Grand Temple in a millennia. So you kind of get to play with the idea that everything is new. And I, as a storyteller, I'm like, how do I introduce that to my players? Do I just tell them? Do I have NPCs that say, this tradition thing seems like a cute thing. Maybe we can do it for 15 years until we crush the Order of Reason, and then we can go back to our separate ways. Or alternatively, this is our heroic last stand, you knowing how things are going to kind of turn out, which brings up a question to me. One of the things that frequently happens is we get future fates. We get information on how things could turn out. For someone running a Sorcerer's Crusade game, is there anything useful there? Like, did you ever do flash forwards? Or is it just kind of something for lore hounds? Like, oh yeah, House Selene eventually becomes the Cassandra complex, which I totally fucking whiffed on, by the way, in Lore of the Traditions. So I got to write during the feedback period, hi, my name's Terry. I wrote this section. This is wrong. I made a lore mistake. I'm new to this. I had only done 200 episodes of Mage the Podcast at that point. My bad. So I hope someone read that and be like, first timer. And just kind of went from there. Travis probably just fixed it while I wasn't looking, but because Travis is good like that. But anyway, yeah. So what is the role of future fates, and how do we introduce that sense of this is new and unsettled within an actual game?
Yeah, I think there are a couple ways of doing that. One, the one thing I have to say about the future fates, and they were invented for Sorcerer's Crusade, but most people have experience with them in M20, and they serve completely different purposes. Yeah. So they were originally created in Sorcerer's Crusade, and I've heard Satyros talk about this in some interviews. You know, he was writing this book, and he wrote 100% of the core book. Other people contributed pretty heavily to supplements, but he wrote the main book, and he was writing it, and he was like, this is Mage, and we're stuck into a canon, but like the whole point of Mage is you can remake the world. I have to open up the freedom for mages to influence things. So he effectively put the future fates in there to be like, maybe it'll turn out the way it worked in the books you have read and love. Maybe it'll turn out this way, to like invite storytellers and players to deviate. He wanted that to be an emphasis because it's Mage and there that door needs to be open. And in that respect, I think it's important that it's in the book. And I think it gives you some ideas about what if I start nudging the characters in that direction. If you don't have players that go deep into time, or you don't have a strong reason for lots of prophecy, invoking them directly is a little harder. Whereas in M20, it's okay, the previous editions of Mage had very different views on things, and we want everyone to feel comfortable here. And what has actually happened since we shut down shop and did all of these things that not everybody liked happened. And the future fates are literally invitations to different settings that you're opening with, like a different set of assumptions your characters have going into game one. They're very different dynamics. So whereas I think in M20, you have to have some idea of like, what were the major like defining events that happened in the past, and what do your characters know about the world they live in? So you have to pick some future fates. In Sorcerer's Crusade, as long as you're comfortable ignoring canon, they're kind of optional. Like, the game still works without them. And that was kind of the approach that I took. I wasn't careening towards canon. I was letting my players guide me. So I didn't really lean on any particular future fates.
Did you ever opine on whether historical figures were mages or sleepers? Did you make Da Vinci a mage? And I guess, how did you view using historical figures?
Yeah, so this is an area that I differ with a lot of mage players on. So I view mages as humans. And I've had exchanges even with writers who are like, oh no, you can't do this. Mages are a monster. Mages are XYZ. You know, you can't just say a wizard did all of these things. And I do think the example that gets brought up most often is like, were mages responsible for like the Holocaust? And I think there's a certain amount of just like pushing that on a fantasy model that squicks me out a little bit. But when it comes down to the historic figures that clearly inspire the mage stories, like I'll use Tychoides as an example. Tychoides is directly inspired by Tycho Brahe. Mages and magic, by and large, is a metaphor for what are the most extreme things humans could do. Because even in the real world, we remake reality. I mean, we peer into black holes. What? You know, when you look at JWST, I'm sorry, like the things that you generally do with spheres is not as dramatic as some of the stuff that's happened in the real world. You know, in theory, you're supposed to push beyond reality, but sometimes it's hard. So my view of mages is they're a metaphor for humans at their most extreme. They're not a different thing. They're not a wizard. And so, yeah, my game was full of historic figures because that's the metaphor I use for mages. A couple of the big historic figures I used, as I mentioned, I was going to use Cesare Borgia. He didn't end up on screen, but he was definitely pulling some strings behind the scenes. One of the historic figures who did show up on screen was Pedro Alvarez Cabral. So I had the burning of Kerala happen in the game. The players got to witness that and fight against him. And Pedro Alvarez Cabral, I mean, people might not know that name, but he was one of the people directly responsible for, you know, the Portuguese sidling up to Kerala and being like, this is going to be ours now and you're going to deal with it. And he was a major colonialist figure, and I made him a void seeker. And I wanted the players to have to confront that. I had a couple other historic figures. I had the grandfather of Nobunaga Oda pulling some things behind the scenes. I really wanted him to make it on screen. He never did. The players did not end up wanting to go towards Japan. We ended up going north to Mongolia instead.
As you do.
So, yeah, as you do. You know, when we left China, I was like, Japan? They were like, Mongolia. So, okay, fine. But he was pulling the strings behind the scenes. He was responsible for some trade and transit that influenced a lot of the early game. And so, yeah, I definitely did that, because if you don't, especially with the Order of Reason, if you're unwilling to make mages historic figures, then what is the Order of Reason doing? Because I don't like making them a weird conspiracy, because if you make them a weird conspiracy, that gets into some modes of storytelling that leads to some icky context. Like, I'm sorry, most of that conspiracy mess is anti-Semitic. And when you refuse to make historic figures that we have seen and know about into Daedalians or technocrats, that means they're the even spookier, creepier, more powerful than those people. Those people didn't really accomplish this. Like, that's the mode it lends itself to. I'd rather just make those people technocrats and treat mages as the humans that are pushed so far they recreate reality, because that's what we do. That's what humans do. I know not everyone approaches the game that way, so I want to emphasize, I completely understand the people who do not want to tell stories that way, but that was my approach with Sorcerer's Crusade.
One of the few elements that kind of gets retroactively added to the canon and kind of disappears all of the mycelium drive in Star Trek Discovery is Skyriggers. We have no contemporary source on that. And Skyriggers are kind of this gateway drug to this alternate history, Age of Exploration punk thing. And we never quite get a great explainer of how a Skyrigger even works, which is, in retrospect, fine. You know, they're like silver. Silver has an agreement with the elements that it gets to do whatever the hell it wants. So if you get a large enough fork made of silver and you attach it to a boat, it can go into the sky if you know how to sky knife boat good.
Yep.
That's a remarkably concise summary of some of the oddities of Mage. To what degree did you introduce maybe alternate history and allow for the fantastic?
I definitely did a fair bit of that. I would say the Indian story arc and the piracy on the Indian Seas story arc were the two that saw the most of that. The players were briefly on a Skyrigger during that piracy story. They leveraged the Skyrigger very heavily to fight that dragon. It was the only way they could handle it. And that was a lot of fun. Oh, it was so much fun. We threw so many dice. It was so ridiculous. He had like 100 hit points.
Yeah.
In World of Darkness.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. But ultimately, none of my players took that much spirit. And specifically, my players chose to play Mystics. When I started the campaign, I'm like, do you want to be Mystics or members of the Order of Reason? Go nuts. And everybody played Mystics. I very briefly had a player try to play a Daedalian later in the campaign. Didn't last very long. And so just things didn't organically go that direction. But man, I would love to do a Skyrigger story. I picture it a lot like a somewhat earlier Renaissance style of, I forget the name of the movie. It was a very early silent film where a bunch of people go to the moon and fight moon men. And it's in black and white. And the moon, like the rocket lands in the moon's eye. And it looks very angry about the whole thing. It's iconic.
I think it's literally a trip to the moon.
Yes, I think it might be a trip to the moon. The Smashing Pumpkins invoked it for one of their music videos back in the 90s. I imagine it like that. Yes. Tonight.
Which, the moment I hear it, I can only think of the song about Billy Corgan losing his car keys. But melancholy and the infinite sadness. Anyway.
But yeah, I definitely did some alternate stuff. especially with the Celestial Master NPC. I had a lot of fun. They had a couple scenes in her observatory, and she did crazy things with lenses, and like she had hundreds of lenses mechanically structured all over her observatory, and she would like carefully manipulate them into alignment to pierce into certain umbral realms. I had a lot of fun coming up with aesthetics of how her instrumentation worked. Yeah, I would have liked to have gotten into more spirit exploring, but it wasn't where the characters were focused. So we didn't do too much of that.
It seems interesting that in the trichotomy between faith, science, and magic, to you, it's more of a science and reason. How graceful is magic going to be? What fights is it going to pick? Because eventually it will be enveloped. But there are certain elements that are going to persist because they are just so deeply woven into it. And it seems like faith is almost this fuel underneath everything that is kind of pushing it along. It is not three independent things. You have this lava of reason and change that is going over. Faith is almost the mountain it is spewing from, and magic is trying to figure out what bits of high ground it's going to keep. As you had mentioned, the entire world of darkness is things used to be nice and they're not now.
Yeah, that's the story.
Do you feel there's a version of Sorcerer's Crusade where it really is a kind of an equal fight between the three, or do you really feel like it's a foregone conclusion that if you wanted to have that game, you would have to push it back four centuries at maybe the Sundering or something, or before the fall of Rome or practically?
I think this kind of gets into a thematic question for the world of darkness. Mm-hmm. This is a tension that I feel a lot in Mage and Changeling, in that these games invoke a lot of hope and a lot of urban fantasy. And the rest of the World of Darkness fandom is like, no, everything must always be terrible because this is a game about horror and despair.
Darkness. No parents.
Darkness. Yeah, exactly. And this to me typifies like an exchange I saw on Twitter. I won't name names, but someone was basically posting and being like, what if I want to be like just like a really nice himbo gangrel? What if I want to be? And he like went on to describe this like gangrel he wanted to play that was just like the ultimate nice guy, but a gangrel and a vampire. And like, can I be off type? And certain someone who is associated with White Wolf, I won't name names because I'm not a big fan of what he posted. And I want to, you know, not pick fights, but this is an example of the tension, said like, yeah, you can absolutely do that. I'm like, cool, we're starting good. And then he went into just so long as you're invoking the themes of humanity and the struggle. And I went, the golden rule is the only rule. And I walked away from the thread before like my fingers involuntarily hit the reply button. Because here's my view on this tension. If you want to play a World of Darkness game, capital W, capital D, World of Darkness game, you're never going to win that fight. You're never going to reconcile all these things. You're not going to have a kumbaya story. Who cares? Like, if that's the story you want to tell, if you want to overcome that, if you want to broker peace between the Order of Reason and the traditions and kick the Gabrielites to the curb and imagine what a future world might be like where the Weaver gets its act together and gets back in balance, do it. I mean, is that a thematically World of Darkness game? No. Does that make it any less valid than a thematically World of Darkness game? No. The golden rule is the only rule.
So I am fascinated by the precursor to the NWO being like, it's like that meme where it shows the precursor wolf and then a modern dog and how far it has fallen. And it's like the modern NWO, I will convince you by writing this academic paper that will influence textbooks in 30 years. And then the Gabrielites that I will influence you because I have two swords and I can use them both at once.
Yeah, there's a whole thing in there about how the Gabrielites have doves and hawks. Nobody plays a dove Gabrielite.
Well, that's
the
thing.
I've never seen a dove Gabrielite NPC. They're not interesting characters. They don't drive the narrative.
I think a thing that's kind of left on the cutting room floor is the thread I want to do is you have the craft basins that say this is all done. You have the Celestial Masters and the Void Seekers who are almost dilettantes more than anything else. You have the High Guild and so on, which is almost non-magical, seemingly. So that leaves this interesting war in my mind between the Caserophi and the Gabrielites. And one of the important things about the Caserophi, which make it really work, but also prevent it from being an interesting story, is how non-political they are. They are not the internal police of doctrine. They are just kind of rooting out corruption and taking down baddies.
Yep.
What if they had their own agenda? And now we have this 400-year, 500-year precursor of the shadow war that people said was always brewing between the Syndicate and the NWO or something like that, except for all the modern sources prior to M20 say, oh, no, we get along fine. And then somehow that thing was kind of manufactured out of nowhere. But like, yeah. What did the Caserify? I feel as if as a plot agent, they are underutilized.
Yes, they really are. The Caserify get, you know, their 2-page write-up and then they get name dropped a few times in a couple of the source books. They never get fully fleshed out. We know someday they will become House Janissary. We know that a lot of the themes about like the secret thing that no one knows about, that's like, not so sure if the order is corrupt, were reflected in the skeleton keys, even though the skeleton keys are a totally different thing. And then
yeah, and they're a sleeper like, organization. Yeah.
The Caserify to me feel like the coolest thing in Sorcerer's Crusade that they never quite knew what to do with, or they never quite got around to getting that book green.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Whatever that situation might be. The other thing about the Caserify to me, you know, we have a number of groups in the technocracy that will eventually defect and join the traditions, but they remain technomancers. You know, the virtual adepts are the virtual adepts. The etherites are the etherites. The Caserify become the Janissaries. The Caserify join the Order of Hermes when they finally like bugger off and leave the Order of Reason behind them. And the thing that speaks to for me is when I was doing research on the period and all of these figures, the thing I came across is every single major thinker in the Renaissance was an occultist. All of them. They were all occultists across the board. And then I looked at the Order of Reason that was all like, oh, up until Arete 3, you don't believe in magic. And I know I've commented kindly on that plot point before. I still think that plot point is interesting in a contemporary setting. I know not everybody agrees, but I think the first, like, 1-2 Arete 2020 technocrat that doesn't know they're doing magic, they don't know that what they're doing and what those deviants are doing is kind of the same thing. They haven't figured that out yet. Like, that works for me thematically. It does not work in 1500. When you actually, like, read up on these people and what was taught as normal, it doesn't make any sense. And the Caserify especially for me typify that, like, we somehow operated in the Order of Reason that didn't believe in magic and then just like joined the Order of Hermes. It was fine
till they were all purged.
Yeah,
which also kind of came out of nowhere. And it seems like they should be having a shadow war with the Ali Bateen in some way. And it's one of those things where to me they refuse to kill each other. Mm-hmm. It is a war of recruitment. That is their ideological war. That in the same way, through Byzantium and Ixos, they wanted to see the unity of humanity, but were skeptical maybe of the Batini notion of it, that they thought that the Order of Reason was the way to achieve it. And they are the subtle side of the Gabrielites, as it were. I would love to see that kind of be their antipode, as it were. Are there any other groups in Sorcerer's Crusade that you feel people sleep on, that you're like, hey, this is actually really cool?
Yes, but unfortunately, they are groups that don't have a lot of words to rub together. So the two groups to me that really stand out are the Maktashaf al-Nur and the Dalolaushi, fully acknowledging that both of those names are kind of a mess, but they're the names we have to work with. And in the contemporary setting, they have been folded into the technocracy. But in Sorcerer's Crusade, no, they have not. They absolutely have not at all. You know, for all of the writing in the most recent technocracy book about we're not separate, we're not conspiracies, we are the same group, stop, you know, othering us, makes sense in a modern setting. I think it makes for a better story. In Sorcerer's Crusade, like, no, you have technomancers in China, and they would have followed a completely different path, and they wouldn't be, they wouldn't, the relationship between occultism and science, again, all of the scientists in Europe were also occultists, like, let's accept that that's a historic truth, but, like, the relationship between mysticism and science in China would still be very, very different, even though, again, they would have all these spiritual beliefs and be pursuing science. And then, you know, you're dealing with everything that came out during the Middle Ages in the Middle East for science, and that whole tradition that is about to run face first into colonialism. We know these groups existed. We just don't have any word count on them.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are mystic equivalents of this that would exist. You know, when you think about, oh, what's the one Indian group of mages we know of? The Chakravanti. But like, how many people live in India? it wouldn't just be one tradition. So I think there's a lot of it would exist, but we don't have word count on it. And I think that's where a lot of the fun places for looking things up yourself and sort of spinning out what those places would really be like if you set the game there.
I don't like the Delalushi being all part of one happy technocracy, because to me, it kind of suggests that the technocracy has a unified notion of progress, and it is a very Western notion. I liked the idea that they had these two wings that looked like they were pursuing the same thing, but if you drill down philosophically, they were very different. That one group is pursuing order in that there is a right way for the world to be conducted and we shall guide it, and another one has this notion of progress at its core, that there is a better, even if the people we progress on don't like it or want it. So
yeah.
I do think it makes sense that there would be different things, that this is the technocracy is the group advocating progress, and the definition of progress is going to change in different places. So that I kind of liked them being three different things, and it let the technocracy be what you needed it to be in different areas. But at the same time, I fully understand that you want colonialism to be bad everywhere, which requires the technocracy to be bad everywhere, because the technocracy is the bad guy in Victorian Mage. Anyway.
I mean, so I agree with you there in terms of having the different views. I think the problem with the old setting for the Dalalaoshi is they were secret conspiracies hidden in the conventions. And I didn't like that, because here's the thing. If I look over like today, 2022, real world, and I look over at China and I think, what are the technocrats in China pursuing as like a guy sitting in, you know, his living room watching TV, like watching YouTube on his TV? I can tell you what those differences are. They are apparent. I would rather there be schisms in the technocracy. I would rather we take this like emphasis on unmutualism and go, what are the actual fights about modernity? Let's let them exist and throw this like conspiracy mess aside. Like if I have to have a multiple vision of technocratic future, I'd rather it be that. And making the groups that trace their lineage back to those Asian technocrats, you know, yeah, we joined up because the world globalized. So like we joined up. The other thing for me about that is, you know, if we're honest, say Japan or South Korea, they're completely on board with the Western technocratic operation. Like they are part of that system. Happily, China and North Korea and Russia are not. Russia briefly was, and then it wasn't. And so, you know, even then, the East-West divide doesn't really work. I would rather have the space to acknowledge that stuff.
Okay.
And I don't think at any point the technocracy or order of reason has been written in a way that lends itself to that messiness. I want that.
It came across as two secret Asian conspiracy at the time. Got it. To me, it was one of those things where it was a sign of technocratic hubris that says, of course, these people who have been submitting me reports. And it was almost a satire to be like, well, the Eastern Division is doing it in, and they have a different, they seem to use a different masthead at the top of their paper that shows this different symbol. But I mean, he's my subordinate. Of course, he's doing what I need, and I don't, the flight's too long, so I don't want to worry with that. But yeah, I would also have taken more information about what the technocratic infighting is as an alternative. What did you do to either placate historical sticklers, if there were any, or make it feel like that was the real period? Like, to me, one of the key things that makes that time is your food is very seasonal. It's going to be remarkably sour or salty, depending on how you can do things. And like a crab apple is the sweet part of the meal. That is the big thing to me. And oh, by the way, nothing you will ever see will be above 5 stories tall. You're like, it towers 50 feet above. What to you were kind of the important things to make it feel Sorcerer's Crusade?
I agree with all the things you just said. Food definitely came up a few times. I thankfully didn't have any historic sticklers. I was actually the biggest historic stickler in the group. I did way more research than anyone else expected. So one of the things I did is in my narration, whenever I did something, whenever I had a setting, have something that would have seemed impossible at the time, but in terms of our current experience, isn't that grand. I called it out. I said, this is impossible. I talked about it in really glowing, sort of fantastic terms. You know, one of the mages in Venice in that first story, his sanctum went underground like five stories in Venice. That's not even really possible now.
Yeah.
In 1501, that is absolutely the result of magic. And I made a big deal out of, you just keep going downstairs. How is this possible? The claustrophobia is going to begin to creep in because you know how far below the waterline you are now. And so some of it was just really calling out where a thing wasn't possible for the time. I did a lot of that. There were definitely the food details. I brought in details for clothing. So I really enjoyed like describing the vestments of the patriarch and having the actual political position. So having the Patriarch of Venice and talking about that history, having the Doge. The Doge and the Patriarch didn't necessarily get along. And the Doge was more the political leader. The Patriarch was the spiritual leader. And like, what did that mean? And building up those resentments and making that part of the story definitely contributed to that relationship. When we got into China, the characters were pulled very quickly into the political courts and the emperor and the grandness of the emperor and his family. And they had sort of been pulled into a spiritual influence and they were very alien, which just ramped up the, this isn't a setting you're comfortable in. Even the Akashayana, while they were from, you know, China, they had no experience with the imperial court of China. That wasn't their domain. And I did pull them out into the city and show that contrast of like, how are people living in the city at this time? What is Cathay actually like at this point in history? So a lot of it was like looking up standards of living, looking up actual political structures and representing those. And then occasionally details like food and clothing, drawing a lot of inspiration from art. Like it's almost easier to look up art of the period and be like, oh, what are they eating? How are they dressed? And that lends itself to the sort of narrative voice you're going to end up using as a storyteller. And I feel like capturing the aesthetic of the historic period is more important in a role-playing game than the minutiae and things happening in just the right year, et cetera. I definitely fudged a few things to get certain events into my story once it had started because they serve my narrative.
And for storytellers who are looking to do this, do you have any advice on running Scourge?
Yes, I do have advice on running Scourge. Don't use the rules in the book.
Okay.
So I tried to run the actual Scourge rules as written for a month or two, and I didn't like them. So one of the main aspects of Scourge is you pick up like modifiers when you have negative things happen, and coming up with a modifier for one or two like dot Scourge effect that matters is really hard. It's kind of the equivalent of paradox flaws. I also don't particularly like paradox flaws. More often than not, it's like, if I make it punchy enough to be meaningful, it feels like I'm beating my players down when they have like a one level paradox effect. And if it doesn't do anything, why did we take the time to like come up with a paradox effect? So what I did for Scourge is the Scourge always transformed the magic, which is how it happens in the narrative. Like when you read about paradox effects in the narrative, it's like, oh, the magic reshapes reality differently than what the mage had in mind. And so what I did is, oh, you had a one on your Scourge die and you only had one Scourge at the moment. Some minor inconvenient thing is going to happen. The other thing to emphasize about Scourge is it, with paradox and the straits in Victorian, it's going off when you gain paradox or straits. And most of the time that means you failed. You know, if you have 8 paradox and you're like, I'm going to do a vulgar effect. You know what you're doing. You know what you're about to walk into. And maybe like it's dire enough that you're willing to like trigger your paradox because this magic absolutely needs to happen. But 9 times out of 10, the mage is just going to be like, I'm not going to do a vulgar effect right now because I know what's good for me, you know? And so you don't have a lot of these like paradox on a successful magic effect thing. But the way Scourge works is you accumulate it exactly the same way as paradox. But there's no threshold where it's more likely to trigger. Every time you do a magic effect, you roll a Scourge die that has to be a different color. And if it's a 1, all your Scourge goes away, all of it. There's no like roll dice to see how intense the effect is. If you've got 8 Scourge, an 8th level Scourge effect happens, and it was a 1, so it's bad. If you roll a 10 on your Scourge die, all your Scourge goes away, and you have a level Scourge effect equal to however much went away, and it's good. And so what I did is I transformed the magic. And, you know, if it was a 1 Scourge effect, it's like, I actually had one of the first Scourge effects resulted in the Order of Reason taking notice of the characters because they had decided to go in after an Infernalist, and they discovered the Infernalist was planning on disrupting the city and messing with it. And they were like, I'm going to go in and try to, you know, untether their enchantments. And they just got a ton of scourge, and they rolled a one, but it was a successful roll. It was a greatly successful roll, but they got a one on their scourge die. And so their effect happened, but it then careened out much further than what they'd intended and got the attention of the Order of Reason, and then there were negative repercussions. And so I enjoyed that a lot more than the traits that took effect. And it's really, really easy to do, because it's just like, I've got so much scourge in my pattern. I got a one. What do I do with that? And if you get a failure and a one, then that's really the equivalent of a true paradox backlash. Like, a whole different magic effect can happen. It can be not even vaguely resembling what was trying, you know, the magic that the player was trying to do. It's just the scourge effect. But if they succeed, it's going to be their effect and just be like, well, if I was just like the biggest jerk storyteller and did the abusive hubris thing that I shouldn't do because it like crushes the player, and I would normally do it, but they just rolled a one and lost eight scourge. So I'm going to do it, and they're going to be fine with it because they know they just lost eight scourge. And that's when you get to have those moments without the player feeling like you're stomping on their fun. Like, when the dice come up like that, players are more willing to lean in to the negative story. When you do that stuff randomly, and there's always that temptation as a storyteller, it's not taken well, because it's like, oh, you're just not letting me have fun. And so those are moments where you can just be like, I'm going to take the gloves off, and everybody's going to be okay with that. And so, because the flip side is, when they roll a 10, reward the heck out of them. I had a couple 9-10 positive scourge effects, and I was just like, wow, an impossible thing that is officially in the book. You can't even do it with spheres, and it's going to happen because you just rolled a 10 and lost 9 scourge. You know, the doge that had become a demon of the 10th order is going to explode into a cloud of bubbles. Solved. Like, yep. I didn't do that, but just like off the top of my head, when they know that that's also possible, it just lets you do some extreme things that normally players would probably like push back against. And so I really encourage people to use scourge like that. It was very successful. My players loved some of the bad and good moments that came out of that result.
Did you tie it to virtues?
I did not end up tying it to virtues. I know the virtues are in there. Virtues kind of live in the same place as resonance for me. I should use it, and I'm just not good at tracking it.
Just curious. You didn't bring it up, and I just wanted to check. Yeah. I guess my kind of like last question would be, if there had been an M20 Sorcerer's Crusade book, what would you have wanted to have seen in it?
The thing I would have wanted more than anything else, and this isn't a core book thing, I'm going to jump right to supplements, is I really think that Sorcerer's Crusade needed a lore of the traditions, lore of the convention style text. You know, if we think back to what it was like when those lines came out, it was more like the Libellus Sanguinis books, the high clans, low clans kind of books. We have all of these new groups, and all we really have is a 2-page splat on most of them. You know, you get like the Swashbuckling Handbook, and you learn a little bit more about the High Guild because, you know, we get Ars Cupididae, but really that's paradigm. We don't really find out about their politics. And the High Guild is a perfect example of, we think of them as the proto-syndicate. The common consciousness about the syndicate is all about our modern economic system and hyper-economics and capitalism. And even, you know, the Golden Guild and the Invisible Exchequers are about the creation of capitalism. But that's not the High Guild. That's true mercantilism. That is an entirely different thing. And man, would I have killed for, even if it was just a chapter's worth of convention book and not a full convention book, I would have killed for a chapter on them. And I feel like most of the groups in Sorcerer's Crusade, even the ones that are the same as in the modern era, the Choir Celeste and Sorcerer's Crusade, like, we need a full book on them. Like, we need a whole chapter on them and a whole chapter on the Gabrielites to be like, why do the Gabrielites view them as corrupt? What are the, you know, Choir Celeste really resisting? We have the outline, we have the ephemera of a lot of these things, but there was never the word count to fully develop them. So in terms of a core book, I would have loved to have seen more on settings. I would have loved to have seen a little bit more about what is the culture of the time? You know, what does it mean to be in these regions? Because again, there was just only so much word count. But if we're going to talk about the source book I wish existed, it's that group's book.
Nice. Victor, thank you so much for joining and sharing your experience as a storyteller and all-around knower of mage things. Is there any particular project you'd like to point people at, or are you just enjoying that RPG retired life?
I'm partially enjoying that RPG retired life. Right now, I'm trying to navigate the Twitterpocalypse because I had started doing these very long threads on Twitter, mostly about Changeling. I was starting to think about doing some other games where I would take a piece of media and then just go on kind of a rambling microblog. How could this manifest in Changeling? I had a couple ideas for Wraith and Mage as well. And then Twitter blew up. I've done one or two more and I liked it because it let me sort of prototype ideas quickly in a format where people would accept, you know, quick thoughts. The medium let me approach the content a little differently. I haven't done one in a few weeks. Just because I don't know how I feel about putting them on Twitter. I'm trying to find another place to put those, but that's the thing I've been kind of putting out into the ether that I'm the happiest about. There are a couple ones that I'm really happy about. I did one based on the Corinthian in Sandman and one on Drag Queen Story Hour. And what does, you know, letting your little group be that visible mean to like the queer stories in Changeling? So those were the kinds of things that I spent time pondering. I'm probably going to keep doing those. So if you want to hunt me down on Twitter, that's a good place to find that stuff.
And a link to that will be in our show notes. Victor, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was great.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where yes, I have used three different set of microphone settings between the intro actual episode and outro, thank you for noticing. And where when we run Sorcerer's Crusade games, we strive for the historical accuracy that rivals Inglourious Basterds, Pearl Harbor, Shakespeare in Love, or Newsies. This episode was made possible by Oracle Sean Gallagher of the Losk of Seraphi House that hunts down people who double-dip tortilla chips and ends them. Oracle Benjamin Bendel of the Lost Group of Solificati who tried to turn lead into funk. Oracle Buck Gregory of the Lost Hermetic House Beats, which laid down fat beats centuries before anyone else. Oracle Christopher Phillips of the Lost Voidseeker Group, which was really just looking for a comfy cave to rest for its winter and may have actually just been a group of bears. Oracle Guy Coon Stewart of the Lost Kosian Circle Group that was searching for a cure for when you sneeze when you look at the sun. Oracle Josh Hiller of the Lost Artificer Group that was super good with Legos, like crazy good. Oracle Puka G of the Lost Guild House that tried to get adjunct professors reasonable pay and exploded in a ball of scourge. Oracle Neil Patterson of the Lost Cabal of Pure Thought Group between the Hawks and Doves, known as the Docks, or Hoves. Oracle J. Widener of the Lost Celestial Masters Group, who hunted for Pokemon constellations. Oracle Mikhail of the Lost Bettini Sect that totally knows where they're going. No, they're masters of correspondence. They don't need to ask for directions. Oracle the crew of Erebus of the True Head of the Order of Reason, the Viasilicos, and their Nepo baby daughters, the Princess Viasilicos. As well as Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad of the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Simsek, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Patrick McNamara, and also Alex Alexia, Andrews S., Anand, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaise Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Chris B., Sinchatis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scrimder, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenke, Fragarock, George Lara, Henry Kraft, Eobull, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jason Vines, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Jolene Andes, Lulz and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leroy Bryce, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Proyl, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Schnabelta Krieger, Starfish, Stephen Garten, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, William Connolly, William Martin, and Zach Rules. Thank you for your support. Our EP shoutout this week is to Eli Levenger, who I assume bears no relationship to Levengers, which is a company that seems to sell remarkably expensive notebooks and book-related things. For instance, if you want a disc notebook and want to pay $31 for 300 sheets of 3.5 by 6.5 inch paper, they've got you covered. My favorite area in the gifts section was the For Her stuff, which had barely feminine colors, like a purported pink that was more of a peach or dusty rose, and just kind of a generic lavender, which I actually kind of like. Also, they have a book scarf, which is a scarf you can tuck books into at the end. This really feels like the fastest way to deal strength plus two bashing damage at a book club by putting a bottle of yellowtail in each end and just rolling dexterity plus melee. Finally, they have a $60 double eyeglass case so you can take not one but two pairs of glasses with you. As someone who wears glasses and has literally never needed this, I don't know if this is genius or idiocy or what I am calling genidiocy.
Eli, thank you for your support. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super like this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hop in Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. We are also on Mastodon at dice.camp/@magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye. I'm going to need to figure that out. But I like the idea of being like, what did Mage the Podcast ever do? Oh, they wound up turning Mage the Ascension into a card game. I cracked open the Hunter book, and the first thing it opened to was the Arcanum. And I'm like, I feel like this may be a little bit of kismet. I think I know what games I'm running it.
At yeah. Gen Con.
Blah, 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 blah. I'm a podcaster. Billy Corgan is 55.
I know. And bitter enough to be older.
Like, Billy Corgan is an AARP. Every member of the Smashing Pumpkins can get Moons Over Miami for like 20% off on Tuesdays before 5 p.m.
My God. No, Darcy is young and perfect forever.
That was like someone made the observation. One of the changes, like the podcast folks made the observation that all millennials are now in first and second edition considered grumps.
Yeah, we are.